Yeah, that's right. Y'all know it. And all the time. For those of you that may not be aware, that's an old, like, churchy thing. It's a declaration of truth, but it's definitely an old churchy thing. Yeah, it is good. We are continuing the sermon series that we started a couple of weeks ago called Game of Thrones. And it's a reminder that we are at war. And it's not wars that some of you may think of, whether it's in the Middle East or elsewhere, or maybe you think back to wars of history, or even some may think of culture wars when they think of wars that we fight. But this is a war that is unseen, invisible, and more often than not, it's overlooked. It's something that we disregard, often not because of there's malice in our hearts, but because we aren't even aware that it is happening. And far more than a battle for territory or land or a battle for power or for influence or prestige or glory, this war is for your soul. And we spent a considerable amount of time fleshing this out, but the thing that we came down to was that everything hinges on the outcome of this war. Everything important in your life flows out of this battle. Everything that we face in our personal lives, our struggles with sin, our struggles with addiction, the struggles in the world, and even the way that we interact with others often come out of the overflow of this war that rages on. And much like real-life battles throughout history, the core that we have discovered is that in the battle for our heart, only one is able to wear the crown. Only one can sit on the throne of our heart. And God has placed a rightful claim to that position. He has earned that rightful place, and everything else that places a claim to our heart is a usurper, is acting out of rebellion against God's perfect plan. But again, so many of us miss this central truth. Jesus said in Luke chapter 16 that no one can serve two masters. Either you hate the one and you love the other, or you are devoted to one and despise the other. Whenever you try to serve someone or something with a divided heart, it tends to be a losing proposition to everybody. If you've ever been in a relationship with somebody who has a divided heart, you know what that's like. You know that eventually somebody is going to feel neglected, underappreciated, underloved, undervalued, because you can't serve two things. Every alliance in history where two rulers have vied for one place of power, even the harshest and most firmly defined alliances, fall apart because no one can serve two masters. And so we've begun to go through and identify and work to right our understandings of different kingdoms that vie for our hearts, different gods that lay claim to our hearts. And we'll discover how dangerous they are, how deceptive they become, and we will look at how we as a people can begin to place our trust and our hope and our faith in God, where he belongs. And this morning, this is one of those tough ones. It kind of comes on the heels of Pastor Franklin's message from last Sunday, And it continues a thought process. In fact, we're going to start with the primary core that he was in Matthew chapter 19 to lay the groundwork for where we are going today. So Matthew 19, Pastor Franklin shared a story that most of us know if we've spent time in church, a story of a rich young man who came to Jesus looking for the answer to what must I do to inherit eternal life. And this is what Jesus said to him after establishing that he had essentially, by his account, lived a good life, followed the commandments in Scripture. This is the prescription that he gave him. He said, sell your possessions and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me. And the man had built his life on the merits of his success, which often we equate with money and possessions. And the Scriptures say he had much of those things. And because his life was so built around his success and around his money and around his wealth, he couldn't see past it. And so when Jesus extended him with care and compassion in his heart the opportunity to follow him and him alone, the man walked away sad. But after he walked away, Jesus looked at his disciples and said this. He says, then Jesus said to his disciples, truly I tell you, it is hard for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. And I want to stop there because the challenge for most of us is that we read this statement with gratitude in our hearts, because most of us are not rich. At least that's how we see ourselves, correct? Most of us aren't going to raise our hands if I say, are you rich? And if you would, I'm not asking you to do that, but if I would, some of you would do it cheekily, like to just prove a point, or because you know where I'm going, because you're just smart like that. Some of you are just really smart. The reality is that too often we see statements like this and we say, well, thank God I'm not rich, because you're right. It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Some of us, we know the last statement that I intentionally omitted from Luke 16 that says no one can serve two masters. You either love the one and hate the other. You are devoted to the one and despise the other. You know that the next statement is you cannot serve both God and money. You know that. I know that. It's there. It's actually going to be up on the screen here any second now, hopefully, if the computer cooperates. There we go. Thank you, James. But you know these things, and you're grateful that you are not a rich person. You are grateful that because you think, and you know, you can probably even see your bank account in one column. You can see the credit card balance in another column, and you think, yeah, no, that ain't me. Money is not my problem. Money can't be my God because I am not rich. Now, I'm going to for one second ignore the global truth in that I believe, and I did not fact check this and that I did not plan to say this, but I believe that if you make $25,000 or more per year per household, you are immediately in the top 90% worldwide. So y'all are rich. You just aren't maybe like mega rich. Like if your barrier for entry is Bill Gates level, or was it PewDiePie that you talked about last week? I actually know who that is. It's some guy that streams on YouTube and does video games. Older folks, if you've never heard of it, don't. It's fine. It's not worth your time. But if that's our barrier for entry in the discussion of money and the discussion of riches, then we will always find somebody like Jeff Bezos, who's about to lose half of his wealth here soon, but has, what, $120 billion? Like, if that's your barrier for rich, then yes. If your barrier for rich is winning the Powerball, then yes, you're not rich. If your barrier for entry is making $150,000, $175,000, $250,000, then yeah, you're not rich. But we must not allow ourselves to disregard the teachings of Jesus on money, Because if all that Jesus had to speak about money were to people like Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos is the owner of Amazon.com. Mark Zuckerberg is the owner of Facebook, just in case you weren't sure. Richest man in the world, they are. If that's all that Jesus had to speak to, that's the only ones, then he wouldn't have devoted 15% of the Gospels to talks about money. Because Jesus didn't spend most of his time with rich folks. He spent most of his time with common people like you and like me. So if money can't be my God because I don't make six figures a year, then Jesus must be wrong. And Jesus must have been short-sighted. But I don't think he is. I don't think he was. Because I don't believe that there is an idol that's as persuasive and as deceptive as money. Because you need money to live. And it is very, very easy to convince yourself that your concern over money, your obsession with money, is healthy and God-honoring. Now, sometimes we pay lip service to the fact that money isn't important. We will say money doesn't buy happiness, but if we were honest, many of us dream of winning the lottery that I don't play, but I've dreamt of it. Some of us dream of writing that novel or writing that book that gets turned into a movie that your story becomes J.K. Rowling's story of being a multimillionaire and a mogul all of a sudden. Your dream is to discover that you have a long-lost relative that is a billionaire, that they have no other family but you, but and so suddenly your net worth is eight figures. I'm thinking five zeros. Five figures isn't that much, but it's still something. You know what? Getting a five-figure inheritance right now would be kind of amazing. Who would say no to even a $10,000, the lowest five-figure inheritance you could get? Who else would say that that wouldn't make an impact on your life right this second? Money, for many, is the ultimate dream. We obsess over it, we fawn over it, and we fawn over people that have it. We stress over it, we fight over it, we divorce over it, and with greater and greater frequency, it seems, people kill and are killed over it. Mark Twain once wrote, "Some men worship rank, some worship heroes, some worship power, some worship God. And over all of these ideals, they dispute and cannot unite. But they all worship money." You see, it's not about the amount that you make or the amount that you have that defines whether or not you fight and lose the battle with the kingdom of money. It's not about the balance of your checkbook. It's not about the level of your retirement portfolio. It's not based on whether you have investments. It's not even about the way that people see your stuff and how people treat you based on your income. It's about your heart. It's not about whether you have money. It's about whether money has you. It's not a question of am I rich, but it's a question of do I trust in money for the things that only God can fulfill? Because if that was real, I've had the opportunity to know people who are on the lowest levels of poverty and some in the highest echelons who actually do have this 6 and 7 and 8 figures of income that I can't comprehend. And I've known people that make orders of magnitude more than me on an annual basis, but do not worship money the way that I have. And certainly I've met people who have very little, but who make money the center of their lives. You see, the God of money isn't restricted to those with wealth or status. When we allow money to define our sense of security, our sense of satisfaction, our sense of status, it becomes an idol. When we allow our status and our satisfaction and our security to be wrapped up in money, it becomes an idol. And I tell you what, it is an easy idol to allow to creep into your life. And if you don't place yourself on guard against it, it's an easy battle to lose. And for God to take his rightful place on the throne of your heart, we have to deal with the kingdom of money that lays claim to our soul. Jesus knew that money mattered. He knew that it was, for many of us, the forefront concern on our minds. And because money makes the world go round, he saw that money would be one of the most, if not the most, powerful stumbling block that most of us would face in the pursuit of him. Money and the pursuit that it takes up the vast majority of our time. And for many of us, it's the most important thing in our lives. So that is why Jesus offers so much about it. But there's a key here that we can't miss. As Jesus is challenging this idol in your life, as Jesus is challenging the way that we see our finances and we see money and we see the God that is behind it, little g, God, understand this, because this is a secret we miss. When Jesus challenges us to dethrone our God of money, he doesn't do it without a critical promise. Reread what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19 to the rich young man. When he says, sell your possessions and give to the poor, that's not where he stops. He has an and there on purpose. And you will have treasure in heaven. One of the things that we have to recognize as we battle here is that the challenge of Jesus is never without a promise. He's never asking us to sacrifice without the promise that we will receive more when it matters. See, what Jesus calls us, when he challenges us, when he expects us to obey his commands, he always does it because he knows it's in our own self-interest. So as we journey through this together, know that the challenge that I'm placing before you, number one, is no small thing, and I think we can all recognize that. But recognize that when Jesus asks you to lay down the God of money, he always does it with a promise. There's a short story in Matthew 13 that says this. It says, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovers and hidden in a field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. The kingdom of heaven, the treasure that Jesus is offering for us, he's comparing to something that is worth giving up everything for. And the reason it's worth giving up, the reason the man sold everything he owned for the treasure hidden in a field, is that the treasure he found was worth far more than what he currently owned. That it was a no-brainer. He, in his excitement, sold everything he owned to buy that field. Because he knew it was going to change his life. He knew everything about him was changing with that. Ultimately, this man would have been an idiot if he hadn't sacrificed everything in order to receive the immeasurable treasure that he found. And what Jesus is saying is that the treasure that this man found, though it will change his life, what we are offered makes it pale in comparison. The treasure that God offers to us makes the treasure the man finds in the field pale in comparison. So never lose sight that when God asks you to surrender something, he always promises to repay it exponentially. And know that he is looking out for your ultimate eternal best interest, because when you dethrone the God of money in favor of the God of the universe, everything will change. So this morning, I want to challenge and offer three core principles that will shift your perspective and challenge the way you see your money, your possessions, and yourself. And they're going to be interconnected, but they're meant to help us have a proper and healthy and godly, heavenly perspective on money. And the principle number one is a principle of ownership. It's a principle of ownership. And this principle begins with the reality that we are not our own. If you serve and follow Jesus, one of the core principles of that is a recognition that we don't belong to ourselves. That Jesus paid a price, Jesus paid a ransom on the cross for my soul, for my life. And therefore, I belong to him. Psalm 24, verse 1 reminds us that the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live within it. A messenger from God named Haggai reminds the people of Israel in the book that bears his name, Haggai 2:8. And God says this, he says, "The silver is mine and the gold is mine, declares the Lord." So all things belong to him. The books of the law in the Old Testament remind us that even our ability to work and to produce wealth comes from God. It says, "Remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth." And then in his letter to the church in the city of Corinth, the Apostle Paul reminds us that our very soul and life belong not to me. He says, "You are not your own. You were bought with a price." You see, something changes when you see your possessions, when you see your money, when you see yourself not as your own, but as belonging to God. Because when I don't own something, my care and concern, my obsession with it diminishes. And how we understand our money and our stuff significantly impacts how we use it. And so when I see myself not as an owner of my stuff, but perhaps a manager, a caretaker, but instead I see God as the owner, we begin to change the way that we treat that stuff. Because if God owns it, and I've just been placed as a steward of it, before I would invest it however I saw fit, I would spend it how I wanted. Because, of course, it's mine. It's my money. I can do with it what I want. But when I begin to see it as God's, when I begin to recognize that it's not mine anymore, our priority shifts. And instead of investing it how I want, I started to ask myself, "God, how would you spend your money? God, how would I best serve you with my finances? Because it's not really mine anymore." It's kind of like living in a rented house. Now, one of my dreams is to someday own a home. I currently live in a church-owned parsonage, and that's been kind of the life I've lived early in my ministry. And I don't begrudge it. It's been very, very much a blessing for me in the past, but I definitely would love to do that. One of the things, if you've never rented before, one of the things about living in a rented home or a home that you don't own is you don't have a vested interest in its upkeep. There is something that at very least you want it to be upkept, but you're not about to invest your own money into it. I mean, has anyone ever actually done that? Like they've bit the bullet and just gone and fixed something in a rental home? I've done it. And I hate it. I've been bitter about it because the landlord should take care of it. But no, I'm going to have to do it because they're not. And so there's a sense of detachment that happens because it's not my responsibility. And when you serve a good landlord, when you live and work with a good landlord, they take care of you. When you own a home, everything falls on you. Everything is your responsibility, and you reap all of the rewards. Ownership matters. Ownership changes the way you see something. Ownership is the beginning of how you move forward in that relationship. So when you see your money as yours, when you see your stuff as yours instead of God, you have a fundamental misunderstanding of how he designed you to live and how he designed you to act. Here on our earth, for us in this time, we need to recognize that this is a temporary setup. That the way that we live our lives, our homes, our stuff, our money, only tell part of the story. Because the life we live here is short in comparison to eternity. And so if we only invest in the now, if we only invest in the here, if we only invest in our rental property, then we're going to find that we miss out on what God is offering to us. God's hope for you is that you will see and understand that your true home is in heaven, and he's calling you to invest in that home that will last eternally. That is where he wants us to place our investment, to put our time and our effort, because it is the home that brings eternal investments. Which brings us to our second principle. Principle number two is that our treasure is where our heart is, but also our heart is where our treasure is. It's a two-sided principle that cuts both ways. On the one hand, you invest your time and effort and money in the things that matter to you. For example, many of you have some sort of investment into retirement because it's important to have a sort of end game when you're too old to work. Some of us will even be able to retire while we're youthful enough to enjoy it, and others of us will die in the pulpit. I mean, die in our jobs. I'm kidding. But for many of us, we invest in our retirement because it's important to us. You pay your mortgage because your home is important to you. I've invested in my education because it's important to me. You invest in your children's extracurricular activities because they're important to you. We could give countless examples of why you invest your time and your money the way you do and how it reflects your priorities. Just take a look at your life and you'll be able to identify what is important to you by how you spend your time and money. It is a well-known fact. You invest in the things that are important to you. But what's interesting and what often gets overlooked is the opposite of that truth. That your heart goes where your treasure is. Because one thing that happened, I mentioned earlier that I've met people that have money. My uncle is one of those guys. He has made out very well in the world of business. And about 8-9 years ago now, he and he had a group of investors purchase the Phoenix Coyotes. They're an NHL hockey team. They're now the Arizona Coyotes. He's responsible for that. Suddenly, though I am a diehard Toronto Maple Leafs fan, suddenly I felt a bit of a vested interest in the Phoenix Coyotes. Because my family were involved, and their success or their loss impacted my family. So even though I didn't have any personal money on the line, I had an emotional investment into that team. So now it mattered to me whether they won or lost. It mattered to me whether they made money or lost money, because it mattered to somebody that I loved. Now my heart followed my treasure. Another example could be that until a few years ago, I'd never actually filled a box for Operation Christmas Child. I've been part of churches my whole ministry career that has supported it, and I have preached it, but until a few years ago, I'd never actually filled a shoebox myself and tracked where it's gone. For those of you that don't know, Operation Christmas Child is something we're involved in through Samaritan's Purse. It's a nonprofit organization that we pack and send shoebox-sized gifts to kids in third world countries that may not have ever received Christmas presents before. But in my last church, I invested in my first personal shoebox, and I sent it off, and you actually are able to track it and to follow it. And suddenly I cared about that specific box because it was in something I invested my time, my effort, and some money into, because my heart followed my treasure. If I were to invest in a stock at random, suddenly that stock would be my new favorite thing. And probably that company would be my new favorite thing. For some of you, you don't need a stock investment to care about General Motors. But I don't care. I could care less. I drive a Kia. It doesn't matter. I obviously know nothing about cars. But if I made an investment, if I bought stock in General Motors, suddenly you want to better believe that I'm going to care how General Motors does. And I'm going to want them to do as best they can. And I'm probably going to want to buy a General Motors vehicle next time I'm in the market for a vehicle, because my heart follows my treasure. And Jesus is challenging his followers to invest wisely, because he knew that where you invest your treasure, your heart will follow. Matthew 6, 20 and 21 says, "Store your treasures in heaven, where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. For wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be." Jesus knew that your heart always goes where you invest God's money. Jesus knows that there's a direct connection between your heart and your wallet, and there's really no separating the two. They are inextricably linked. Aunt Randy Alcorn goes as far as to say, "As surely as the compass needle follows north, your heart will follow your treasure." It's like Jesus is saying, show me your bank account, show me your receipts, show me your checkbooks, and I'll show you where your heart is. So according to your spending habits, according to your budget, according to your bank statements, where are your treasures? What is important to you? And if we're being honest with one another, are you content with the answer to that question? And I will say this, God has challenged me to be faithful, to invest in his kingdom and in my eternal home. But sometimes my credit card statements don't reflect that calling, don't reflect that challenge. Sometimes, maybe even too often, my spending reflects my true heart. And I know that every time I realize that, I'm given a choice of what to do with it, whether I'm going to act on it or if I'm going to ignore it. And my hope for you today is that you don't ignore what God is placing in front of you. Which brings us nicely into our third and final principle, which is this: we need to sacrifice short-term for long-term gain. We need to sacrifice short-term for long-term gain. The world is full of schemes that convince people they should buy something with no money down and pay it back over a long period of time. Places like Aaron's or Rent-A-Center make millions of dollars by offering what appears to be a great deal on the surface for somebody that maybe can't afford a new television. So instead of saying you have to pay $700 now, you can pay it off in just a payment of $27 a week. Of course, what they don't tell you is that at the end of that contract, you have paid $1,100 for a $700 television. You always lose when you want and sacrifice for short-term gain. Long-term, it always becomes pain for you. You always lose. It may seem like a great deal now. It may save you money in the short term, but what is the cost? That principle sounds an awful lot like the words of Jesus in Matthew chapter 16 when he asks two questions. He asks, what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? Is anything worth more than your soul? The world is constantly offering you a chance at happiness. If there was one thing that I've seen in advertising, it is that desire to sell you on the one thing that you're missing to become truly happy. They are offering you the hope that in this item, in this product, that you can discover happiness once and for all. Tech companies always try to sell you the hope of life being easier or life being more productive or even cooler. Weight loss, exercise, and supplement companies sell you on the hope of beauty and health. Clothing companies offer the hope of self-esteem or even friendship if you buy their products. Sports equipment offer hopes of higher athletic achievement if you invest in their wares. Beer commercials promise dude bros all over the world that they would get babes and friends and party good times if they drink their beer, which never made any sense to me even when I was like a 17-year-old dumb kid. I always thought, I don't think it's going to magically transform my life. But that is the promise if you look at their advertisements. The promise that is offered, regardless of where it is that you find yourself drawn in by, the promise is always one that you'll find lacks. You'll always find that if your hope is that this new tech gizmo is going to revolutionize your life, you'll get it, and yeah, it'll be shiny and nice and new, but ultimately it won't change your world. You'll find, even through weight loss, if I could tell you how many people who have been on a weight loss journey because their hopes that when they finally reach their goal weight, they could feel like they are worth something, and only to find their goal weight is just a little bit further, and that they found that their self-worth is still just a little bit out of reach because the promise of that physical health still falls short. If I could tell you just how many people believed that this next promotion would be the one that would fulfill them, only to find that that doesn't bring the fulfillment they hoped. Friends, it is false hope that the world is trying to sell you. But the tragedy is that the price that we pay is often far beyond what we intended. And so we mortgage not just our eternity, but we mortgage our families, we mortgage our sanity, we mortgage our health for things that have no eternal significance. And then after all of this investment in stuff and in money and in promotions, we find that at the end of our lives, they all end up at the same place. The treasures that we quarrel about as kids, the friendships that we lost over them, the treasures that we sacrifice for, the things that we break up marriages over, every single one of those things all end up in a landfill someday. You can gain the whole world, and all you have is a treasure that moths and rust can destroy and thieves can break in and steal. People who invested in Blockbuster once thought that they were shrewd. Once thought that there was a no-miss opportunity. People once believed, and rightly believed, that BlackBerry was too big to fail. They were the biggest tech company in the entire universe at the time. And when you invested in them, it was a sure thing. I don't even think they're trading on the stock exchange anymore. More and more and more people will try to convince you that this is the next thing. That this is the thing that's worth losing it all for. But even the biggest companies, even the Googles and the Apples of the world, who are some of the most wealthy companies ever to have existed, none of them last forever. Which brings us to the whole point. When you spend your life investing in these things, investing in wealth, investing in success, and investing in stuff at the expense of eternity, you will always lose. Because at some point, this life comes to an end, and we move into eternity, and everything that we've spent our lives investing in becomes worthless. The investments we've made of our time and our money and our efforts pale in comparison. Jesus tells a story of a man who had achieved financial success through his farming endeavors. He now faced the question of what he should do with his wealth and decides that what he's going to do, because he has so much grain and so much stuff, that he's going to tear down his barns that aren't big enough anymore, and he's going to build bigger ones. And in Luke 12:19, the man says this. He says, "Then I'll sit back and say to myself, 'My friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.'" It seems like his investment is about to pay off for him. He's been a titan of industry. Now he'll kick back and relish in his success. But the man forgot something critical. He spent so much time worrying about his golden years. He spent so much time investing in his business, investing in money, trying to better himself, that he forgot that his life had a significantly shorter shelf life than his money. Because Jesus continues in verse 20, "But God said to him, 'You fool, you will die this very night. Then who will get everything you worked for?'" And Jesus closes with this. He says, "Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God." For too many of us, we get stuck on serving the God of money, in pursuing the things of the world, the things that tell us that we've become convinced that we have to have in order to be secure, in order to be satisfied, in order to have status and significance. And we often do it at the expense of eternity. But here's what God wants. God wants us to invest our treasure, our time, and yes, importantly, our money in the part that matters. Because the Bible calls this life, compared to eternity, they call it a vapor. Here today and gone tomorrow. But we are offered something that goes far beyond that. God's hope for you is that you will allow yourself to see the treasure that is available to you, the one that far outweighs anything that you could hope to acquire. And God's desire for you is to see that you live in light of eternity and store up your treasures where nothing can touch them, and where you will discover an eternity of wealth and prosperity that can never be taken away. I'm going to ask that the worship team would come back up. We're going to close in a song. One of the challenges that we face, and one of the common themes that you're going to see running throughout this series is the theme of surrender. Because before you can deal with the idea of money, at its core, you've got to be willing to surrender that God to our God. So as we join together, we're going to close with a song that is declaring our surrender and giving God our heart. And my hope for us is that if you're here and your struggle has been with money in some way, shape, or form, whether you've been relying on money to be your source of significance or your source of security or your source of success, your source of safety, God is offering to trade that lowercase g for the God of the universe, who offers far more with far greater measure. But to discover that, we have to be willing to surrender. So as we close this time, I want to let you know the altars are always open. If there's something, if this is something you're wrestling with, it is maybe the hardest battle you ever fight. But it's a battle that you must win with the help of God. Don't ignore it. Don't underestimate it. Choose to surrender it to God and discover the treasure He has for you.